for a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Good evening, it's 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Henry Walker, and Juliana Gonsalves. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie. Let's start off with your local news headlines. While the Adelaide Street Shelter at 38 County Street is winding down and will close on March 31st, Council voted at their last meeting to allow for a short-term extension of Lionhearts Incorporated's lease for the organization's vocational laundry program to continue. The daytime employment-focused program currently employs 8 individuals and provides laundry services to shelters and care providers across the city. The program is set to move to 309 Queen Mary Road and become part of the integrated services at the new transitional housing site. However, the location is still currently under construction. The extension for the laundry program to remain in the former Frontenac Public School building aims to prevent disruption until the new location is ready. The extension allows for up to an additional 6 months, starting April 1st. Lionheart CEO Travis Blackmore spoke before council and stressed the impact of this program and the importance of it continuing without disruption.
This is about maintaining something that already works, supporting people in a practical, dignified way, helping partner organizations operate efficiently, and doing so without adding pressure to the system. Importantly, allowing the program to remain in place creates no additional impact to the surrounding community beyond what already exists today. This is not a long-term request. It is a short-term practical step to ensure continuity while permanent location is finalized. It allows us to transition responsibly without disruption to individuals, partners, or the broader system. Our program has been, in our view, very successful. In terms of seeing them acquire housing, some of them move on to acquire their own housing, so not just through Lionheart's transitional housing, but acquire their own housing, some of which have come through the program since 2022. So it's got a proven track record. How it affects the broader community is we have a number of contracts with some local shelters to which we offer the laundry service, pickup, cleaning, delivery back. We have 8 potential people that it could impact, coming already from their past and struggles, many of them off the street already, but again have gone forward to a brighter future, a brighter path forward, and this is a big piece to their puzzle or their life story.
While it is confirmed shelter services will not be continuing after March 31st, residents in the neighborhood surrounding the site still had concerns about Lionheart's continuing to operate from the location. A petition was presented to council from 88 residents around the Adelaide Street Shelter that asked the city not to renew or extend any further contracts with Lionhearts at the location after March 31st for any reason. One of these residents came to speak before council on the issue.
The entire Adelaide Street Shelter has been a prime example of what not to do when opening, operating, extending, and now winding down an emergency shelter. Our neighborhood, our city budget, and most importantly, the people Lionhearts was supposed to shelter and serve have endured more than enough from Lionhearts.
Councillors questioned Blackmore in regards to these community concerns.
I just want to acknowledge some concerns that we've heard from community members. I just want to ask you if you could confirm something for me. So can you please confirm that if this extension for laundry is granted, that the building is only going to be used for laundry services and it will only be for staff members that you have hired? It won't be for guests, it won't be for visitors, it will not be a spot to hang out. Can you confirm that, please?
I can confirm that 100%. Just for staff, just to do the laundry contracts. That's, it's a 9-to-5, basically.
And the residents in the area have asked that you move faster. Can you?
There is, if Queen Mary Road is ready on the 1st, we'll be in there. If it's ready on June 1st, we'll be there too.
When it came time to vote on the extension, Councillor Gregory Ridge pointed to the message received from neighbors of the site.
I have had a number of very long discussions with constituents that live around the Adelaide Street Shelter. We've heard some of those concerns this evening around how the operations have gone there, or how they've affected the people that are living there. I think it's important to try and make that distinction. And the message that I've received from constituents is very clear in terms of the petition, in terms of it, which is that they just do not want that management to continue in that space, even with the laundry program.
However, Councillor Gary Osteroff pointed to the impact this program has for those employed and the city's network of services.
The value that's going to be given to those involved in the vocational training and how it benefits the vulnerable in our community. And I think we might be taking our laundry for granted at home. We really should not, because it does give a lot of dignity and self-worth and for the givers and the receivers here. And we can be part of the giving here.
With a vote of 10-3, the city will enter into a lease agreement with Lionhearts for the use of 38 County Street for vocational laundry services for not more than 6 months, commencing April 1st. Following the expiry or termination of the lease with Lionhearts, the city will move forward with the demolition of the former Frontenac Public School building. With the end of shelter services just a few days away, Councillor Gregory Ridge asked Blackmore about lessons learned from the Adelaide shelter.
My one question for you is, looking at this entire scenario with the Adelaide Street Shelter in the space, is there one piece that you could point to that you would be a lesson for any organization running a shelter space or any service for the vulnerable that you've learned from this?
It's tough. I think every organization out here would say more funding. You feel like you're putting band-aids on issues and trying to triage as best as you can, but you're equipped with band-aids. I know funding across the board is an issue for any agency whatsoever. That's what I would say. More funding and changing hearts and minds to really understand the issues of everything you've heard tonight, whether it was the CTC pieces. It's hearts and minds toward actual real human beings and seeing them at one point and wanting them to be restored to some extra afforded purpose, maybe some extra dignity for their life, and realize they're a human being.
City Council has formally declared student debt a municipal economic concern, recognizing that provincial student loan policy has direct consequences for the city's workforce, housing market, and long-term fiscal health. The motion comes in response to recent provincial changes to the Ontario Student Assistance Program. In February, the province restructured OSAP, shifting funding from 75% grants to 75% loans, ending the tuition freeze and introducing a 2% annual increase. The shift is expected to increase the average four-year undergraduate's debt by more than $7,000. Councillor Connie Glenn, whose district includes Queen's University, brought the motion forward.
So 3 years ago, I sat down with the students when we were forming the post-secondary working group. And the big question that I asked them was what their big concerns were and what they needed help with. And their answer was simple: food and housing. And I had the same conversations again recently. And now it's food, housing, and how am I going to pay off those loans when I graduate, let alone afford a house and a family? And the shift in 3 years tells us everything we need to know about where we're headed. Students and families who cannot afford to pay for school out of pocket now have to take out loans that are going to have interest on them. And they're being asked to bet their future on debt before they even get started. Kingston is a post-secondary city. Queen's University and St. Lawrence College aren't just institutions. They're economic engines here in Kingston. They're community anchors. And what's happening to the students impacts all of us.
The motion points to growing local pressures, noting that rising student debt is pushing graduates away from smaller cities like Kingston toward higher-paying urban centers. At the same time, Kingston's senior population is growing at more than twice the provincial average, while working-age population has declined, creating an urgent need to retain young workers.
Our numbers are already telling a story we need to take seriously, and that was illustrated in the motion. We've got a senior population that's growing at twice the provincial average, our working-age population shrinking. The federal government workforce in Kingston area is projected to fall by 35% by 2031. Half the jobs in the city are education and healthcare sectors, and they're facing, 18% near-term retirement rates, and we've been struggling to keep doctors and get doctors, so we're staring down a workforce crisis. And at the same time, we're making it harder and more expensive for people to train for the jobs that we need filled. So our community pays when a student in debt leaves because they can't afford to stay. We don't just lose a resident, we lose a doctor, a teacher, and yes, a taxpayer. And that loss is very real to us. It shows up in our housing market, our healthcare wait lists, our labor shortages. It shows up every day here.
The motion also directs city staff to bring forward a bylaw to add a post-secondary student representative to the city's Housing and Homelessness Advisory Committee. The motion will be shared with provincial leaders, local MPPs, student organizations, and municipal partners as part of broader advocacy efforts.
So the motion asks for three things that I think are very clear and reasonable. A return to a stronger grant-based model because grants open doors and loans close them. Interest-free provincial student loans following the federal government's lead. Recognition from this council that post-secondary education is a public good and not a private burden. Municipalities may not control LOSAP, but we live with the outcomes in our housing demand, our transit, social service, our economy. Affordability is not just a federal or provincial issue, as we all well know. It lands here first. We're the first to see it. And it lands the hardest here. So this is about fairness. It's about making sure that talent, not income, determines who gets to succeed, who gets to move forward with having that house and that family. Because when students start behind, our entire community is going to end up there.
When it came time to vote, council approved the motion unanimously. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. You are listening to your Queen's Campus Beat, Queen's Campus News here on CFRC 101.9 FM or online at cfrc.ca. I'm Henry. Queen's University will increase residents' fees by an average of 3.5% for the 2026-2027 academic year, following approval from the Board of Trustees on March 27th. The decision affects approximately 5,051 students housed across 18 residence buildings, the majority of whom are first-year students. According to the university, the increase is tied to rising operational costs, including staff wages, food services, and utilities, as well as planned infrastructure upgrades. These include washroom revitalization in Leonard Hall, bedroom renovations in Waldron Tower, roof repairs, and expanded Wi-Fi access across residences. Because the residence system operates as an ancillary fee, it must remain financially self-sustaining, meaning costs are directly passed on to students rather than subsidized by the university's central budget. The announcement has already raised concern among students about affordability, particularly as broader cost of living pressures continue to impact Kingston's rental and housing market. In contrast to rising student costs, Queen's financial outlook has improved significantly. A university report released March 20th projects the operating deficit will drop to approximately $2 million, down from an originally budgeted $26.4 million deficit announced in May 2025. This represents a reduction of more than $20 million, suggesting stronger than expected financial performance over the current fiscal year. While the university has not attributed the improvement to a single factor, the revised projection indicates increased stability compared to earlier concerns about long-term financial sustainability. The updated deficit figure will likely play a key role in upcoming budget decisions, particularly as the university continues balancing institutional costs with student affordability. In other news, a newly released Student Mental Health Policy Annual Report presented to the Board of Trustees on March 6th and reported on March 20th shows measurable improvements in student well-being, but not evenly across the student body. According to data drawn from the 2025 Canadian Campus Well-Being Survey, 74% of students reported average or high levels of positive mental well-being, while 58% rated their mental health as good, very good, or excellent. The report also notes increased use of mental health and wellness services since 2022. However, disparities persist. Students facing financial stress, disabilities, neurodivergence, or international status report significantly lower outcomes compared to the broader student population. The report fulfills a provincial requirement introduced in 2024, mandating that universities implement and annually report on formal mental health policies. While the overall trend is positive, the findings highlight ongoing structural inequities in access to mental health support. Finally, in research news, Queen's has secured national recognition for work targeting cystic fibrosis, one of Canada's most common fatal genetic diseases affecting children and young adults. A Queen's researcher has received a national grant to explore new treatment strategies aimed at improving long-term outcomes for patients living with the disease. While cystic fibrosis currently has no cure, the funded research represents a step toward advancing therapeutic approaches and addressing a major gap in Canadian healthcare. Further details on the project's methodology and funding body are expected in the coming months. Once again, you have been listening to your Queen's Campus Beat, Queen's Campus News, here on CFRC 101.9 FM. I've been your host, Henry.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We begin with Monday, March 30th, daytime high of 10 degrees with cloudy conditions. Tuesday, March 31st, another 10 degree day, but those clouds give way to about a 95% chance of rain, and that rain will make it feel closer to about 4 degrees, although it is listed officially as a 10 degree day. Wednesday, April 1st, daytime high of 8 degrees with rain later on in the day, and that rain will cool things off a great deal as Thursday, April 2nd, daytime high of 4, but feeling closer to minus 5, so bear that in mind if you're out and about on Thursday. Friday, April 3rd, Good Friday, 11 degrees with rain and wind in the morning giving way to clouds in the afternoon. Saturday, April 4th, 10 degrees, sunny, beautiful day in the city of Kingston. Sunday, April 5th, another 10 degree day, but another rainy day, 75% chance of precipitation. And that means the start of next week, Monday, April 6th, will be a little colder. Daytime high of 6, feeling closer to 2 with cloudy conditions. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. As a reminder, overnight street parking restrictions have been eased as of March 1st. You can park overnight on marked areas unless the weather conditions require it, i.e. think the heavy accumulation of snow or icy rain. All overnight street parking restrictions will be lifted as of April 1st. In terms of road closures, Berry Street to Queen is still closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Aberdeen from Johnson to William is currently closed to accommodate construction activity and staging in the area. And lastly, you can expect delays on Front Road to Sand Bay Lane for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Please be aware of lane shifts, traffic speed limits, and share the lane signage.
As the snow is finally melting and the sun seems to be shining a little brighter, what's something you're looking forward to this summer? Hey, hey, I hope you're having a great day. It's your girl Gigi, CFRC's newest intern, and you're listening to What's Live at 5 on CFRC 101.9 FM. Coming up on this segment, I've got K-Town's hottest concert and event calendars for the week, starting with events. On Monday, March 30th, check out the Gathering of CBR Canada College Members, an event to learn about each other's community-based research initiatives and discuss the unique challenges and opportunities for engaging in community-driven research in the Canadian college landscape. Join online at 2 o'clock p.m. Did you know there's a creature in the Great Lakes that's older than the dinosaurs? Meet the sturgeon, a living fossil that has survived for millions of years and can live for 150 years. These ancient fish hold spiritual significance in Indigenous stories and legends and have long served as an important food source. But here's the twist. Settlers once saw them as pests, then hunted them nearly to extinction for their precious caviar. Drop by the mighty sturgeon, a living fossil, at the Great Lakes Museum at 10:30 a.m. until 11:30 a.m. And on Tuesday, March 31st, if you haven't checked it out already, don't miss the last day of Kingstonlicious at participating restaurants until 10 o'clock p.m. Understanding early signs, symptoms, and prevention strategies can make a meaningful difference in cancer outcomes. Proactive awareness empowers individuals to take charge of their health and supports a culture of informed, person-centered care. Educate yourself at early awareness, screening, and prevention in breast and gynecologic cancers online at 12 p.m. until 1:30 p.m. Citadelle plus Compagnie will be performing at the Kingston Grand Theatre Rosen Auditorium. Led by artistic director Laurence Lemire, Compagnie de la Citadelle is known for its creative process and intimate performances of classic works and new creations. Through Remount initiatives, the Compagnie also dedicates itself to the preservation of important Canadian dance work, making available iconic repertoire to new generations of artists and audiences. Catch them live at 7:30 p.m. Improv for Seniors will also be happening at the Tet Center at 2 o'clock p.m. until 4:30 p.m. But if you're not a senior, not to worry, you can check out the Level 1 Improv class at the Tet Center from 5 p.m. until 7 o'clock p.m. On Wednesday, April 1st, the end-of-term staff discount at dining halls begins. Staff and faculty at Queen's University can enjoy a 15% discount on door rates at Leonard, John Royce, and Ban Ree dining halls. Treat yourself to a delicious all-you-can-eat meal starting April 1st until April 8th at 11 a.m. The Wonderful Women Community Choir will be meeting at Crossroads United Church at 1 p.m. until 3 o'clock p.m. No experience necessary and all ages welcome. Are you an adult who faces social anxiety barriers? Not to fret, I've got something just for you. A social anxiety improv class designed with extra care to make sure you always feel supported. Drop by at the Tet Center at 5 p.m. until 7 o'clock p.m. The Open Stage Drag Show welcomes all new and veteran drag performers at the Grad Club from 8 o'clock p.m. until 10:30 p.m. And don't miss karaoke at Time Out Bar and Bistro at 6 o'clock p.m. On Thursday, April 2nd, take a cheerful midday pause and join us for a lighthearted creative wellness activity in celebration of spring and Easter. This hands-on wooden egg painting session offers employees a chance to unwind, express creativity, and enjoy a relaxed social moment during the workday. Swing by a spring craft break wooden egg painting at Duncan MacArthur Hall at 11:30 a.m. Also, check out a fantastical medical bestiary at the Museum of Healthcare at 10 a.m. until 4 o'clock p.m. Moving on to the best part of the week, Friday, April 3rd, don't miss the open mic at Storrington Lions Club at 5:30 p.m. until 9:30 p.m. Or if you're looking for a little bit of a later option, check out Friday Night Karaoke at The Buckle at 9 o'clock p.m. Saturday, April 4th marks Amelioba Threads for Change, a student-led sustainable thrift event in collaboration with the Queen's Black Academic Society that transforms donated clothing into community impact. This initiative collects gently used clothing, shoes, and accessories and redistributes them through an affordable pop-up thrift sale. All proceeds support the Amelioba Center for Women and Children, a nonprofit organization focused on advancing access to education, health resources, and community support for women and children. Open to all audiences and free to attend, registration is not required. Swing by Threads for Change at 151 Alfred Street at 11 a.m. until 5 o'clock p.m. Also on Saturday, don't miss the Downtown Kingston Easter Hunt, a community scavenger hunt that's fun for all ages, exploring local shops, solving clues, and hunting for hidden surprises. Join in the fun at Downtown Kingston starting at 10 a.m. The Isabel Bader Center for Performing Arts will be hosting Ballet of Lights, Sleeping Beauty in a Sparkling Show, a magical performance that blends classical ballet with modern visual spectacle. This beloved story is reimagined through breathtaking choreography and initiative stage design as six talented dancers illuminate the stage with glow-in-the-dark costumes. Ballet of Lights creates a multi-sensory experience where technology and artistry combine to bring a classic story into a glowing new dimension. Check it out at the Isabel Bader Center for Performing Arts either at 5 p.m. or at 7 o'clock p.m. And on Sunday, April 5th, swing by the Memorial Center Farmers Market at the Kingston Memorial Center grounds at 9 a.m. until 1 p.m. for fresh foods and to show your support to local vendors. And of course, you know what Sunday means, Sunday Fun Day at the Great Lakes Museum at 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. Have an event you would like to add to our online and on-air event calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at CFRC Music on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. Next up, our concerts calendar. On Monday, March 30th, the Shenanigans kick this music-filled week off at Time Out Bar and Bistro at 4 o'clock p.m. Evan Carlson and Ron Steves take the stage at the Cove Inn from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. with local roots, rock, and classic country. And the Morning Doves wrap up the night with funky jazz music at Musiki Cafe and Whiskey Bar from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. On Tuesday, March 31st, started off a little early with Tom Savage as he hosts Tom's Tunes Day, my favorite, afternoon happy hour jam at the club at the RCH Day, going from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. with doors at 3 o'clock p.m. Live music continues at the Cove Inn from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. as Eric Urin and Megan Ballow bring their ethereal acoustic folk sound, a fiddle and guitar duo you won't want to miss. At 5:30, head over to the Spire for Transgender Day of Visibility featuring the Queen's University Chorus. Expect speakers, refreshments, snacks, giveaways, music, and more. On Wednesday, April 1st, happy April Fools! Not fooling you about any of these concerts, though. Get your midweek groove going with DJ Great White at Hotel Wolf Island from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. with a mix of 60s, 70s, and 80s hits, plus yacht rock, soul, R&B, and 80s new wave pop. At 5 o'clock, head to the Cove Inn for Wings and Tunes with Sean McCullough, live until 8 p.m., and stick around for the open mic hosted by a master guitar player and all-around showman. To finish off your Wednesday at 5:30 p.m., Vince DeBeal brings the country vibes to the Bank Gastro Bar, playing through to 7:30 p.m. On Thursday, April 2nd, kick off your evening at 5 o'clock with Original Thursdays at the Cove Inn, featuring a rare classical acoustic string trio, live until 8 p.m. At 7 p.m., head to the club at the RCHA for Women in Jazz, featuring Juno Award-winning saxophonist Allison Au, live until 9 p.m. Then at 7:30, it's a big night across the city. Classic Albums Live takes over Kingston Grand Theater with Slippery When Wet, bringing Bon Jovi's iconic album to life, note for note. And to close out the night, Old Man Ludecky hits the stage at the Broom Factory from 8:30 to 10 o'clock p.m. with some country tunes. Kick off the weekend on Friday, April 3rd with Deacon and Brody as they bring pop, rock, and indie vibes to Time Out Bar and Bistro from 3 p.m. to 5:30 p.m. At 5 o'clock, the city comes alive with Matt Dixon, the self-proclaimed rock and roll marathon man, as he hits the Cove Inn until 8 o'clock p.m. Also at 5 o'clock p.m., catch Micah Garvin with his acoustic sounds at the Toucan. Into the evening, Groove Infused lights up Time Out Bar and Bistro at 7 o'clock p.m. with R&B, soul, and blues rock straight out of Kingston. On Saturday, April 4th, we've got a full day of music across the city, starting in the afternoon with Sing It, a movie musical sing-along, takes over the Domino Theater from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. with doors at 1:30 p.m. Come out and belt your favorite tunes with the Kingston Meistersingers. Into the evening, River City Junction brings their Canadian blues and retro rock sound to the Cove Inn from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. At 8 o'clock p.m., my son the Hurricane hits Signal Brewery with a high-energy mix of funk, jazz, and hip-hop. At 10 o'clock p.m., Squid Pistol takes over the Toucan, playing all your favorite songs late into the night. And at 10:30 p.m., Sparrow Blue closes things out at the Merchant Tap House with some country vibes. On Sunday, April 5th, finish off the weekend on a high note. Sunday Funday Chicken Pickin' takes over the Cove Inn from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m., serving up some good old country music. At 4 p.m., singer-songwriter Chris Murphy will be performing at Time Out Bar and Bistro. And as the evening sets in, experience something special. Candlelight, Vivaldi's Four Seasons, and more at 6:30 p.m., a live performance by the Listesso String Quartet under the warm glow of candlelight. And at 8:30 p.m., head to the Spire for Candlelight, Queen vs. ABBA, as the Listesso String Quartet brings those iconic hits to life in a stunning multi-sensory show. Have an event you would like to add to our online and on-air event calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at cfrcmusic on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. As the semester comes to an end, so does my time at CFRC. I would like to take this opportunity to thank CFRC for the wonderful learning experiences, and to you, my listeners, for tuning in and making me feel like I've gained an even bigger community. Thank you so incredibly much. So, for the last time, no matter what you're into this week, music, food, dancing, or just pretending you have your life together, I've got you covered. For more details on all these events, check out cfrc.ca or lock in right here on CFRC 101.9 FM. You're listening to Gigi on CFRC Radio, and from me to you, have the best week ever, be safe, be kind, and I'll catch you next time.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and listen on the go, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. This is edition 310. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. On the broadcast this week, I'm going to be sharing a conversation with Rachel Rosen, who is an educator at University College London. Rachel has research projects that focus on the marginalized children and families of this world, particularly looking at the ways that precarious status, precarious situations impact the well-being of children. Rachel, beyond looking at these issues in relation to questions of migrant justice in a context like the United Kingdom, has been really involved in looking at this question throughout the world, and was part of highlighting some really critical issues of injustice that have faced the children of Gaza, Palestine, over this last year. Rachel helped curate an exhibition of children's art work from Palestine, as well as other pieces. This was an exhibition in London that spoke to the realities of children in Gaza in the context of an Israeli state-backed genocidal military war that has taken place throughout the last 2 years. And I think that this is a really important project that we hear about, because it shows the ways that local initiatives and exhibitions and efforts to create space to talk about Palestine are important from different vantage points, from different focus points. Rachel talks about this struggle for justice in Palestine from the vantage points of her research that has focused on the experiences of marginalized children and families. So thanks so much to Rachel for being on the program this week. Rachel, again, is at the University College London. So here's my conversation with Rachel Rosen for Free City Radio.
So in the contemporary context, we're speaking in the late summer 2025, there's been a lot of broad stroke references to quote-unquote women and children of Gaza, which is obviously important. There's definitely a horror to what everybody in Gaza is experiencing that is difficult to put into words. But often in short reports, it's really difficult, I think, also to get a sense of what that actually means. We're getting into a space where we're hearing a lot of statistics, a lot of numbers, but not really unpacking how a reality of genocide today in Gaza is affecting children, and also affecting everybody, of course. I think it's been a really shocking moment in regards to the refusal of Western powers to recognize the humanity of the Palestinian people in terms of practice in relation to policy. So you have really, I think, done a project from what I understand, that has tried to lift up and to speak about this question of Palestinian children. And I would understand that there is an intention here to actually give a sense of the reality of Palestinian children's voice, Rachel. Maybe you can just introduce yourself and give a little bit of context to your project. Also, just locate us. Where are you? Where is this project happening? Thank you.
Great. Well, I mean, thanks so much for inviting me to have this conversation. Rachel Rosen, I work at University College London. I'm a sociologist, and I work on questions of childhood, forced migration, and social reproduction. And I have always been kind of committed to transformative research that's contributes in some way to kind of questions around liberation, to questions around economic and social justice. I take kind of anti-capitalist, feminist perspectives in my research. This is a sort of long preamble because my research itself is not about Palestine or Palestinian childhoods, but I have been involved in kind of grassroots organizing that is very much kind of anti-Zionist. I'm an anti-Zionist Jew, so in anti-Zionist and anti-imperialist organizing. And these kind of two parts of my life have in some ways really come together, I think, in the last few years, when it's become absolutely imperative for us, and by us I mean the world, to be clearly and unequivocally condemning the Zionist state for its genocide against the Palestinian people over the last 2 years in Gaza, but for much longer than that, so since the Nakba, and the participation of many of the states that we live in this genocide. So that's sort of by way of a little bit of background. And so in terms of recognizing that the kind of moral and political imperative and responsibility, accountability that we need to take for some form of internationalist solidarity, I've been involved with a number of different initiatives, particularly in the last 2 years. So with an amazing, wonderful group of colleagues at UCL, one of the things that I think you are interested in hearing about is an exhibition, an event, series of events that we're putting on in September 2025. So this is a collaborative production with many people involved called Palestinian Childhood Solidarity in Sumud. And I can say more about it, but the kind of core points to pick up on what you asked me about. So the first thing is that clearly the settler colonialism targets children. Children are core to settler colonial projects. We know this historically because this is how nation states and ethno-nations build themselves. So we have in Canada the kind of John A. Macdonald's horrible invocation to kill the native and save the child. So a kind of a colonial project through forcible assimilation. We have in Gaza the logic of extermination. I mean, just clearly, there is no assimilation here. This is just the logic of settler colonial extermination. And the children are particularly targeted by this. And we see this in abounding in the kind of carnage in Gaza, the numbers of children, the percentage of children that have been killed, the numbers of children that have been imprisoned, put into arbitrary detention, the fact that starvation is being used as a weapon of war, which we know medically affects small bodies more quickly, so it targets children. We know about snipers targeting children's bodies because we have accounts of this from Palestinians on the ground, most importantly, but also from international doctors who are working. So children are being targeted, and I think one of the questions we have to ask ourselves is, why is it that children are being targeted by projects of settler colonialism and by projects of genocidal projects? So I can come back to that. But I think there's a second point that I wanted to make, which was just one of the key things that I think is important to recognize is while there's a specificity about the targeting of children, my argument is never we should care because this is children. I think the fact that children are being killed and there isn't a global outcry that states continue to support, like the UK or the US or Canada continue to support Israel, shows that there's something, you know, there's imperialist interests in what's happening. Because children are, in international law, meant to be given special protection in war. And the fact that they're not in Gaza makes clear that there's something else happening. But it's not just children. And we're really clear that this is not an argument just save the children for the children. This is an argument for the people of Palestine, because Palestinian children are part of a collective of people who deserve the right to their homeland, to a life of dignity, justice, and existence.
So just to be clear, you had mentioned the continued support from Western governments for this genocide in Palestine being carried out by the Israeli government of Benjamin Netanyahu. So in the case of Canada, for example, there's been a renewal of arms shipments. Despite language shifts, there hasn't been any cessation of this transfer of arms, which I think is an important thing to highlight. Can you talk about this exhibition that you're working on and maybe just give us some details?
Sure. Just to say, I think your point around Canada is clear. The UK is very similar. So the UK has been flying spy planes or intelligence missions throughout the Gaza genocide and sharing this with Israel, continuing to send weaponry and so forth. So I think there's a lot of complicity globally. What we're trying to do, moving on to our exhibit, what we're trying to do with our exhibit is to take up the call of Gazan young people who write in the We Are Not Numbers project. So the We Are Not Numbers project is Gazan young people telling stories about their lives and using the power of narrative, of words, to describe themselves, the people that they know, the people that they love, the people that they live with, the people that they fight with, to tell stories about the complexities of their human lives and to make clear to the world they are more than just numbers. And so we've tried to take up that call, that demand, to recognize, to hear, to listen, and to amplify these stories. And so our exhibition is a two-week exhibition that will include a number of different pieces. So part of it responds to the kind of question of Sumud, the incredible steadfastness, resilience, and struggle for liberation that we see from the Palestinian people are really leading the world with. And so to show Sumud, so we have the photographer and artist Ahmed Al-Alsa, who's in Gaza, who has shared a collection of photographs with us. These are photographs of everyday life, of children's everyday lives in Gaza. And for me, they're powerful and profound because they say, in images rather than words, but they say, we are not numbers. But they also show kind of really strikingly the struggle for life, the commitment for life in the face of such boundless carnage. And so we see a child playing with a game in the sand with a bandaged foot. We see another child sitting on water canisters, presumably in the search for potable water to drink in the context of Israel's starvation campaign. So we see the kind of complexities. We have the Palestinian artist Samer Abdul Nour, who has a collection of three sculptures called Grief and Rage. And his sculptures, I mean, are incredibly moving and powerful. But for me, one of the things that they do is they speak to the fact that children are not, it's not, again, it's not just about the children, but children are relational beings. They live their lives in relation to parents, to other kin and other children. They live their lives in relation to cats. We see the relations, a strong relationship between children and cats that they're trying to save also from Israeli aggression. We see it in terms of the relationship with the land. And so Samer's grief and rage speaks to me personally in that way. We have finally, the final sort of part of the exhibition is Letters for Palestinian Childhoods. And this is an international collection. It's an ongoing and growing collection of letters, of poetry, and artistic work that people from around the world, so from South Africa to Canada to Colombia, have shared with us and that we've curated into an exhibition. So there's text, there's imagery, and there's sound. So we have people reading their own letters. We have artists speaking about their work, and all of the letters are translated into Arabic, because part of what we're trying to do here is to show the second part of the title of the exhibit, Solidarity. So we're trying to both amplify what we're hearing and show and hear how we're listening and acting in solidarity.
One thing I just wanted to highlight in relation to what you shared, and thank you, Rachel, for going over all of this, is this point that you mentioned, the collaboration with a photographer in Gaza and other artists, also, of course, with the work of children from Gaza. I mention this and underline it because I think there's sort of a discourse that I've heard, which sort of perpetuates a certain cynicism around trying to make such efforts to share works in Western contexts. And what I've noticed again and again, in whether it's online, but also in conversation with people in different communities, is when you actually tune in to people on the ground, that community to community connection, people on the ground in Gaza, that community to community connection and making that effort to try to cross that border in whichever way is possible from whichever context somebody's working in, has been underlined as very meaningful. Whether it's people recognizing and seeing the Gaza solidarity encampments, or artistic exchanges like the one that you're involved in, this, I think, it's been made very clear that this is important for people in Gaza. And so I just wanted to underline that in relation to what you described, because I think as time goes on, there can kind of be this sort of corrosion because of the sort of in the sense that there's something possible that can emerge from these projects, from these experiences, from these collectivities, in a sense. So in that regard, I would just like maybe for you to share a bit, Rachel, about why creating space within academic institutions has been something you've worked on, whether it's around this exhibition or more broadly. Obviously there's been a high level of repression within different academic institutions. We could speak about the UK context, but there's many contexts around the world. I ask this question with the recognition that this is a living conversation. This is a living battle.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, and to just give one silly little example, to book a room for an event about Palestine takes about 4 to 5 times longer than it does to book a room at the university for anything else. So we have the sort of big repression and obviously most centrally the big genocide. But we also have these very mundane and little kind of constant steps that we need to press against. And so to come back to your question about why do this in academic spaces, I think one of the reasons why for us it's been so important to create space to talk about Palestine and Palestinian childhoods is precisely because every time we give an inch Every time we stop talking, we won't say this word, we won't use the G, the genocide word. Every time we do that, actually the space for critical, democratic, emancipatory thought, discussion, and action shrinks. We don't welcome more people into the fold, but in fact, we shrink the space of possibility. So partly what we're trying to do here is it's a cultural exchange, but I think it's much more than that. We see it as a kind of an emancipatory pedagogical space, a space of imagining, and a space of imagining otherwise, and a space of enlarging what we can think about as possible in terms of the kinds of worlds we want to live in, the ways in which we think about solidarity and social justice, and most importantly, most centrally, in terms of amplifying the voices of Palestinian people and Palestinian children in this context. I've learned a lot from my work. We've been working very closely with the Emergency Committee of Universities in Gaza. And one of the things, the sort of most powerful lessons that I've learned from working with them is, although Israel has entirely destroyed the physical infrastructure of the higher education sector, knowledge production, the universities, the staff, the students persist. And their persistence is part of resistance. It's part of existence. And so part of what we're trying to do here is centrally amplify the kind of knowledges, the embodied, the cultural, the material, the symbolic knowledges that Palestinians are sharing with us, and sharing with us so generously, I should say, given how quiet the world has been watching the genocide unfold. And so by amplifying this, by refusing to be silent in academic spaces, regardless of repression, I think that's one of the things we're trying to do, is to keep open that space and to constantly try and, I like the kind of metaphor of grass pushing through concrete, kind of work those cracks to try and open up our spaces of thinking and being together.
So, Rachel, this is an interesting opportunity to talk about connections between Canada and Israel as state projects. And I think that this could be maybe a point we could close on. I'll just mention that the exhibition that you're talking about, Resisting the Silencing of Palestinian Children, is taking place in September in London at UCL East. And there's a number of different online spaces around that. But reimaginingchildhoodstudies.com, through that you can find the Solidarity and Samud exhibit. Please share with me any other links you'd like to highlight, Rachel. But the point of sort of zooming out and thinking about the targeting of children in the context of genocide. So people hearing this are, of course, tuned into what's happening in Palestine. You mentioned particular references to Canadian history, quote unquote, and, you know, the involvement of important national figures in Canada, like a former Prime Minister John A. Macdonald, in the targeting of Indigenous children through the residential school program policy. Maybe you could just, you're living in the UK, but originally from Vancouver. If you have any thoughts, just to end on sort of seeing a connection there, and why articulating that and not expressing it as the same thing, but as existing within a continuum is important. And I think that's interesting in regards to sort of a discourse that that can allow us to understand the Israeli state project as existing within a framework of networks of power that are rooted in colonialism.
This is a really important question. It's really important to recognize both the similarities and differences between different settler colonial projects. Because, of course, Canada was colonized during the kind of heyday of European colonialism. This was a project that was understood and sort of highly morally valued in many ways within Europe. And in Canada, the the kind of making of this nation did not take quite, it took a multicultural form, right? So that's why we see projects, extermination projects nonetheless, but we see projects of assimilation more than anything of the native population. So there was obviously a violent killing and incarceration that continues to reverberate today in Canada. But there was also a project of trying to assimilate Native children. So the residential school system, which punished Native children for speaking their Indigenous languages, for example. This was about making them more Canadian. But a targeting of children nonetheless, because we see in any kind of settler colonialism is building, it's an imaginary nation that's being built. And that imagination needs to cement itself to become seen by its population as a true nation. So how does that happen? It often happens through pedagogical projects like the schooling system, like cultural institutions, and children are a key target there. So that's the kind of Canadian way in which this happens. What we see in Israel is slightly different. I mean, Israel was founded as a settler colony at the sort of end, at a period of mass anti-colonial, decolonial uprisings, and in fact, projects of decolonization. And so Israel has always modeled itself as a land with no people for a people with no land. So their myth, the mythology of Israel, has been much more about one, an ethno nation for the Jewish people, and two, in an empty land. So these kind of myths require a different sort of violence, a different sort of state violence project to create the nation. So Ilan Pape writes about the kind of foundational myth of this Jewish state for the Jewish people when you have an existing indigenous population, the Palestinian population. And so from the Nakba until today, we see a project targeting the extermination of the Palestinian people in the name of building this mythic ethno-nation. And so that targeting comes through less through the assimilation projects that we see in Canadian settler colonialism, and more through this kind of slow genocide, or now the fast genocide of Gaza. And that's targeting children physically, materially, in their everyday lives, but also targeting children as people's hope for the future.
Rachel, thanks so much for taking a moment to speak with us today in the UK. Rachel Rosen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was a conversation with Rachel Rosen at the University College London, speaking about her work to highlight the experiences of children in Gaza, Palestine, over these last years in the context of genocide. Rachel co-organized an exhibition in London to speak to these issues that I thought it was very important to highlight. Thanks again to Rachel for being on the program. I'm Stefan Christoph, and this has been another edition of Free City Radio. We are supported by the Social Justice Center at Concordia University and broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m. on CGLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Thursdays at 8 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. and Fridays at 1:30 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m. on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m. on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m. on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m. and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick, Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. And we're also podcasts. Look us up, just search Free City Radio. Thanks for tuning in, and take care.